Hello everyone, and welcome to today's webinar, High Tech Meets High Touch, Using New Technology for Community Building. I'm Janice Foster, Executive Director of Grassroots Grantmakers and moderator for today's call. So let's get started and now turn to our topic for the day and hear from our special guest, Stephen Cliff, Founder and Executive Director of eDemocracy.org. So Steve, thanks so much for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
So first of all, I want to be sure that everybody can hear us. This is a little bit new technology. We've been playing around using the audio that GoToWebinar provides. And so I just want to make sure that you're all hearing. And I'm going to send you a note right now to just say, if you can't hear me, please let me know. And let's not get too far down the road when I think you're hearing me and you're not. So I'll be sending that note in a minute. First of all, let me say a word about eDemocracy.org, and then our special guest, Steve, and then I'm going to turn it over to him for his remarks and presentation. So eDemocracy.org builds online public space in the heart of real democracy and community with the goal of harnessing the power of online tools to support participation in public life, strengthen communities, and build democracy. Starting with the world's first election information website in 1994, and that's pretty remarkable, 1994, if you think about where we were in terms of new technology then. Today, eDemocracy.org hosts over 25 local issue forums and 15 communities across three countries, New England, the United Kingdom, and the United States, and does other work that promotes civic engagement online around the world. So in addition to heading up eDemocracy.org, Steve is a social entrepreneurship Ashoka Fellow and speaker and consultant on eDemocracy. So it's my pleasure to welcome Steve. So Steve, take it away.
All right, well, thank you very much. I'm glad all of you could join us today. And if you enjoy the presentation today, I'm glad that it's being recorded, so feel free to let others know about it. It's a beautiful day here in Minneapolis, so the sooner we get through this, the better, right? So here we go. Get the slides going here. Okay, so here's the problem. The default experience that the public is having online in local communities, particularly via online newspapers, it's a lot of shouting, it's a lot of flames, and it's a lot of conflict. What most people see online when it comes to their neighbors or the people in their community, they see conflict. And it's a sharp, sharp contrast with what they're experiencing, particularly in their private lives, with social networking with their friends. So let's just start from the premise that things are actually getting worse and that we need to counter that. So I'm going to tell you some stories today. And the first one I'm going to start off with is a sort of about unlocking community. Uh-oh, here's a big key. How do we get through? Well, I'm very interested in this presentation and talking about how we connect people who live near one another. And this key is actually part of a good thing. It's the launch of a new community garden in my neighborhood. And a couple of years ago, I decided it would be fun, basically, to organize an online neighbors forum called the Standish Erickson Neighbors Forum. And I did a lot of recruitment in person, put up posters, and we had a couple hundred people when we opened, which is a lot, actually. And one of the first early topics was by a guy named Michael, and he just said, my name is Michael, and I'm interested in establishing a community garden in our neighborhood. There had never been an effort to start a community garden in a neighborhood prior to this, and there were dozens of messages, offers of help, and a call for a meeting. And the key thing was that there was a latent demand and interest in this, but there was no public space for people in our neighborhood to come out like this. I mean, yes, you could go to the 7 o'clock meeting for the neighborhood association, but in modern life, anywhere, anytime has some advantages, and this allowed a whole group of people to coalesce. They met in person. This is really radical, right? You can have an online conversation, but because it's local, you can meet in person. Today, the Standish Erickson Neighbors Forum just crossed the 500 member mark. That's roughly 10% of households. And here's my two kids here are on the right, Liam and Annika, and I'm the kind of guy who sticks kids in wheelbarrows and drives them around the garden. So we've had a wonderful time getting started. We just planted some seeds yesterday. So I'm Steve Clift. You can go to eDemocracy.org for lots of information, or stephencliff.com for lots of old articles. I'll say one thing. I've done a lot of speaking in different countries, and so I'm often informed by what I've actually learned when I go where I go to speak. And oddly enough, I'll be speaking about e-democracy in Libya in 2 weeks, so that should be interesting, to say the least. We also have some Ford Foundation support this year that we received in October for a project we call Participation 3.0, which includes two lower-income, high-immigrant neighborhood forums online. And I'll be talking more about that later, but I just wanted to share the link there because it does provide some context for us to continue convening in this space and working with others. So the two main parts of the presentation are two-way tools, technology, and many purposes. Now, the purposes just kind of flow throughout, but instead of talking about the tools, I'm going to talk about purposes for a moment. But let me just say the assumption we're starting from is community building. We're not starting from the assumption about informing or news, right? Yes, that happens. Yes, people create news and share news, but we're talking about community building, people connecting, solving problems, being a community. That's at the heart of this. And when it comes to using technology in very local places, be it your block or in your neighborhood or community-wide, there's lots of different purposes. And different sites have different ways of approaching these different purposes. But people meet, they communicate, they socialize, they share information, and contacts, advice, you know, like who can recommend a good plumber. They support neighbors who need help. They exchange a lot of opinions. They do generate very valuable community news. They share announcements and invite each other to different events to get out in person. Then they organize or they protest. They try to get a stop sign on their intersection. And then sort of some, I would say, next generation things that you're beginning to see interest in is how you use technology to foster greater collaboration among people, how you orient people toward problem solving, and how you also build bridges and promote inclusion. And we'll talk a little bit about all these types of things in the next half hour or so. But first, let me mention one thing. I've been just launched, I guess, last week, an online community called Locals Online. And for quite some time, I've been trying to organize people who do work at the neighborhood level with online community building. And it, in some ways, most efforts are very individual, very isolated, and its really movement doesn't know that it is one. But we've had 40 people so far introduce themselves, and I invite any of you who are interested in this to join. You can lurk or you can participate. Also, if you want to go more in depth on citizen media, sort of the local sort of media side of this, whether it's Flickr or blogs, I have an hour webinar available on demand with audio, as well as a full hour on issues forums, and which are sort of more oriented toward our community-wide level experience with like a citywide forum in Minneapolis where we have over 1,200 people who talk politics every day in my hometown. And there's different flavors of the of folks who have joined. There are the community builders. There are the folks that come from a news perspective. There are efforts at the single block, a neighborhood, community-wide. There are folks that are building local everywhere tools that will serve anyone anywhere, theoretically. Some are very online, and they promote things that happen in person, think like a meetup.com, for example. And then you have offline folks that are models that have been there for decades or generations or even just a few years that are working to try to move their work online. Some projects are very general, and others have a niche. They're oriented toward affordable housing or environmental or some niche local concern. So a couple secrets. So you came to a high-tech presentation, and I'm going to first tell you that it's not about technology. It's not about waiting for the new idea. To me, what's most important is about desire. It's about outreach and it's execution. So you know, if you have the desire and if you have a community building intent, then your technology choices matter. The technology does not lead this, it's your desire and your mission. But you know, if you have the desire, if you have the mission, if you have the resources, you can make big mistakes with technology that end up sending you down a path that may not have been as good as the one you choose. The challenge is that there might be 100 different choices out there, and 5 of them are legitimate choices, and the challenge is trying to find those 5 compared to the other 95. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some different tools. Some of the stuff may seem elementary. Others you're going to be like, say, like, wow, great, you know, very basic, that's good. So here's the honest-to-goodness truth. The most community building that's happening online right now is CC via email. People go to an event like National Night Out. They pass a paper, piece of paper around. Someone types up the names, sends a note to everyone, and says, hey, here's everyone's email, and then people use it when they need to. So my friend Alberto Monserrati, with a big spark in his eye, said, you know, I've been doing internet stuff for years, but you know, this has been the most exciting thing that I've experienced in a long time, was when he and his neighbors communicated about a stray Rottweiler. And it was hungry and looking kind of mean, moving around the neighborhood, would show up and then dash off. And they communicated about who was feeding the dog to try to see what they could do with it, and they finally found a neighbor who knew how to handle dogs and rescued that dog after, actually, honestly, a couple weeks of communicating and not being able to sort of even get the city to find the dog. So there's lots of examples of that. You grow that up at a little level, you have email discussion lists. Now, this is sort of the, if you're from Washington, D.C., if anyone's from D.C., you're like, well, of course, because Washington, D.C. is like the epicenter of neighborhood email lists. There's even an email list in Cleveland Park that has 10,000 members. Now, it predates the widespread distribution of Craigslist and FreeCycle, and so it's a mixture of Craigslist, FreeCycle, and sort of a civic forum, an issues forum, as we would call it. Keith Hampton, working through the Pew Internet American Life Project, Keith is at, University of Pennsylvania, at college, is it Annenberg School, and he did a survey and found out that 4% of American adults say that they are a member of a neighborhood discussion list or forum. That's 8 million people, and to me, that's a lot. That means that over 20,000, perhaps 30,000 Americans have stepped forward as a host of an online email list, because these things don't just happen. Somebody has to say, I want to start this. That's 20 or 30,000 people who don't know each other, or maybe know one or two max other people who do something similar. And it's a real problem, because they're hard to find, and they're often find out about them word of mouth, and they're often the folks that host these. To be honest, many of them, you know, if there are 20,000 that have succeeded, there's probably another 20,000 that have failed, and maybe could have used a little help along the way. So that's email lists. So place blogs, that's a term for, you know, place-oriented blog. It's the cornerstone of more of a citizen journalism approach. There are some communities that have what you would call watchdog blogs, you know, often anonymous, sort of anti-tax blogs. But, you know, there's a number of them out there, and two of them that I want to mention that I think are really important are highly interactive. One is Locally Grown Northfield. That's a small town of about 15,000 in Minnesota. College town, and the WestSeattleBlog.com. What's important about these two is that they aren't just Hyde Park soapbox blogs. See, when people think about blogging, you know, being a democratizing force, they're talking about democratizing punditry, the stuff you see on cable TV, right? So it's like instead of having 300 talking heads on cable news, there's 3,000 people who want to be talking heads. So it does democratize punditry, but at the local level, it often is more like Hyde Park. It's somebody standing alone, trying to shouting out at us. Well, these two blogs aren't like that. They really involve people who are organizing people to have a conversation. And it shows that the technology doesn't necessarily mean you have to be one way or the other, but I think it's just important to note that blogs are often not many-to-many, and the ones that are should be recognized and are more oriented toward community building, in my opinion, than sort of the Hyde Park model. Facebook. So, yes, you hear a lot about Facebook, and, you know, there are a lot of people who are friends of their neighbors. And so I've heard stories of people who say, oh, yeah, and I've lived in my house for 10 years, and all my, you know, most of my friends are my neighbors, and we use Facebook to organize barbecues, and that's great. But what it really tends to do is it really helps you publicize your private life in some ways. And it's not the same as building public life online. There are some new features, though, or not new completely, but there's the ability to create groups and pages on Facebook. You see a lot more Facebook pages these days. It's actually sort of a better set of tools. But in the past, they've had Facebook groups, which also allow you to create a private space. And so on the screen here, there's a Bladen Center Block Club. And I'll note here, you may see there's a gentleman here with a nice mustache or goatee. This is really important. No matter the technology, this person is sort of the host or the animator. This is about once every month or so, or every week or two. He's doing something on this space to help foster some conversation. Very important. Now, with Facebook pages, you're actually seeing a number of neighborhood associations and local governments are creating Facebook pages. I don't know what percent yet, but a Facebook page has a wall, and this is a version of the wall for the group, but basically a place where people can typically post stuff and talk. And so it's sort of a way to dip your toe into interactivity as an association. I should note that most associations are very leery or concerned about hosting interactivity. They're concerned, they say they're concerned about liability, but I think they're more concerned about sort of the political liability of being accused of a censor, particularly if they're government or a neighborhood association that has some sort of government-ish trappings. There are some great reports, though, for those who are interested in the government piece, and there's a link there. There's two from the UK and one from the US. And it takes a more institutional perspective or elected official perspective, but definitely worth a look at that link. So another very important tool that people are using is Ning, and it basically allows you to host your own social network. People can register and upload their photo and have a profile, and you can have blogs and forums and groups, multimedia, a whole mix of tools. And it was free until in July it'll actually have a charge. So if you want to have under 150 people in your group, it's only $3 a month and $20 a month for over that, essentially. Drupal is an open source tool, and I won't go into what open source is too much, but basically it's a content management system that allows people to create better looking sites. And so what's really important about this is that the resources required to have a nicer look on site that connects people, it doesn't take as many resources to do that in terms of getting it set up. But that sort of obscures often the challenge that it takes to actually create a climate where users help generate that content. And so the there is something you need to look for, right? So a lot of that relates to critical mass. It's that outreach that I mentioned earlier, as well as that lead host. And Joseph Porcelli is the founder of the Jamaica Plains sort of Neighbors for Neighbors effort, which is now extended itself Boston-wide, and then sort of in the startup mode as a nonprofit, as I understand it. And here he is. So he's the guy who created this. And if he didn't play his role, sort of the sheep herder in here, this wouldn't be what it is today. And I think it's also, there's a guy named Hugh, and I forgot Hugh's last name, but there's a neighborhood in London, one part of London called Haringey, which also has sort of come to life and has really shown how to use this tool in particular. So, all right, next thing to mention here are sort of videos, pictures, tweets. Videos on the rise, pictures on the rise. Lots of folks, rather than do their own video work, will leverage YouTube. I just want to make this point, is don't let the pretty pictures obscure the analysis of the there. And what I found is that because it's really hard to look at a forum far away in a local place, and particularly at the text, and get a sense of what people are talking about, people often, they like to see the pictures, and it gives it a sense of life. But sometimes those pictures are actually old, or there aren't so many. And so it's really important if you're going to be evaluating tools or models, or if you decide, we'd like something like that in our community that they have in that town, make sure you look more closely at sort of the volume of different types of content being produced by the users. The greater the diversity of users in terms of numbers, the better. In terms of what actually has the there. Something else is sort of a different, could be a separate slide, but is Twitter is really interesting because it allows for sort of real-time formation of organic groups, right? So people in Northeast Minneapolis just started doing a hashtag, which is like a keyword that allows people to sort of follow each other's tweets. So someone said it's a magical day in Northeast Minneapolis today. Someone said this person is feeling woefully under-tattooed and under-pierced in Northeast Minneapolis today. I think it was an art festival. That's what it was. So, yeah, having some fun with these hashtags, tater tots and rock and roll in Northeast Minneapolis. But what's important about that is that when you have a flood, UK election or Iran election or a crisis, right, people can turn to this tool to have very short form. So when the Minnesota legislature was finishing up the other night, pound MN leg, and people, were able to have group communication. I think it's really important to watch that, and particularly as it gets more and more local, you sort of have these generations of folks, and they come online, you have You had the Usenet newsgroup people, the email list people, the web forum people, the blog people, the social networking people, the tweeting people. And so people kind of, when they come into this, they often find a layer. And one of the challenges is how do you reach people across those different layers, particularly the local level, because if you choose one technology that sort of excludes the other, maybe you can't reach the critical mass you need. So in launching this Locals Online effort, you know, I've been tracking this space and been involved with it for over 15 years. We've been doing neighborhood work for about five, where we went from the citywide level within, and then we started going local. We actually went local first in Oxford and in Bristol in England, based on some local councils, governments that were actually interested in doing neighborhood level work. And that's when we actually decided to bring it back into Minnesota with our neighborhood model. But there are great projects like Front Porch Forum. iNeighbors has been around for a long time. Tools Do is a new site that I've run into. Good Neighbors is a sort of example of an offline model of community weaving is a title they use, coming online. Minnesota Idea Open is actually something a little bit quite different. It's actually an idea competition platform doing some statewide ideas with local ideas in a statewide competition that they want to then roll out to basically helping foster local online competitions of all sorts. So it's pretty interesting, a different way to look at this. But those sites like Front Porch Forum, which has, I don't know, I think in some areas of Burlington, Vermont, they have in some neighborhoods like 80, they said, well, 40% of the households overall and maybe 80% in some places, which is amazingly high. So they're connecting folks, the end users, you could say. And then you have builders. So, you know, I'm trying to connect the people who are building this stuff on Locals Online as an online community practice on eDemocracy's site. I also run a thing called Democracies Online. So if you're interested in sort of the more civic engagement side, e-participation, government input, all those types of opportunities, I have networks internationally from my various trips and the like that I've built up over years. Ourblocks.net is an awesome blog, and neighborhoodsblog.uk in the UK as well. They're both basically about neighborhoods building as a whole in general. But that whole community is increasingly interested in how technology can be used to accelerate that kind of work. A number of these things I've discovered in recent years. So I won't go through them all now, but just say when you get the slides, each of these will link you off to more information. So before we get to questions, I'll have a couple more stories. Or a few more stories, and then a couple of comments for funders as they might look at the space, and then we'll open it up to questions. So, stories. So the thing I'll just say is that my sense is that most of the, I'll call it sort of natural neighborhood organizing online, the things that people just have done, typically are in areas that are fairly middle class with homeowners. And you know, when you hear about digital inclusion or the digital divide, on the other hand, you hear a lot about computer training, access, price, and you don't hear a lot about voice and a lot about sort of generating content. You hear a little more about generating content, but not a lot about sort of how you use these tools to have power in your community or how you use these tools to solve problems. And so we decided, with some support of the Minneapolis Foundation as well as the Knight Foundation's little St. Paul Donor Advice Fund, to focus on two neighborhoods, one in Minneapolis, Cedar Riverside, which is sort of majority East African, mostly Somali, and then in Frogtown, which is like 40% Southeast Asian, which is of that group is mostly Hmong from Laos, and African American and white in that community. And to say, well, how might we do what we know about outreach, but also to try to have this help raise the voices. And so we actually have been fairly successful with the outreach part. So I hired a college student last summer in Frogtown who went to the library and signed people up, the farmers market, the Hmong Arts Festival, the Hmong Town Market. And we opened the forum with over 200 people, and roughly 30% of the surnames were Southeast Asian, or Asian, I guess you could say. In Cedar Riverside, we recruited at the multicultural dinner, and essentially, you know, we signed people actually up in person for online forums, and about half of the surnames were Muslim surnames. And so the Somali community, you know, is pretty quiet on the forum. And tragically, in January, there was a triple homicide at a Somali grocery store. By two 17-year-old Somali youths that were trying to get their car out of the impound lot, and a robbery went bad. on the Seward Neighborhood Forum, which is just south of Cedar Riverside across the freeway where the grocery store is. You know, there's a forum manager who called 911, who's our volunteer lead of that forum. Someone posted, let's have a candlelight vigil the next day, and then 300 people show up, and these are mostly East Africans. But the honest truth is we don't know exactly the demographics of that forum. It wasn't part of, it's all been an all-volunteer effort. But our hunch is that most of the folks are the homeowners and not the folks that were renters sort of just north of Franklin Avenue. Well, on the Cedar Riverside Forum, I mean, people are talking about funeral arrangements, about guns. I mean, some serious conversations with, we have recruited a number of younger members of the community and some young Somalis saying, hey, you know, we got to carry guns to protect ourselves because the police won't protect us. That's a pretty serious conversation. And, you know, we do a lot with the Brian Coyle Community Center, which is right next to these giant apartment towers. And it's a real conversation. So the online conversation was part of the real world. I mean, kids were talking about it in the computer lab, and they were, you know, it was a spark of a conversation. And of course, there were plenty of folks that said, the last thing you want to do is, you know, all arm yourselves so you can be safe, right? So it was a give and take, but it was giving us exposure to, you know, me anyway, to a part of the community that I don't have day-to-day exposure to. And that's one of the ideas about sort of the integrationist approach that we take. We're very interested in how you bring the diversity of these different communities into a single space. And I think it's, if you're trying to do, when you're trying to build community and you're trying to build inclusion, I think it's really important to note that it isn't just about raising the loudest voices or enabling those who already have a voice to have a voice in another center. There's nothing wrong with people who, like our Minneapolis Issues Forum, it's very political. Lots of folks that, you know, are active in different ways are active there. But if that's all it is, if it's just the folks that, like I said, are usual suspects, that's a problem. I mean, why would you invest in that? And another great story, well, actually, within the Somali community is, you know, we've had great discussions about crosswalks. And there's a challenge between basically this big apartment complex here and then there's some other buildings across the street. Where a lot of the elders, sort of senior public housing, and this is some Section 8 and regular rent, market rate rental properties. Started by Mustafa Adam, said that he tried to contact the city. The first reply came from a city council member saying, you know, it's fallen off my radar a little bit. I'll check in to see about it. I decided to take my little flip camera, my little video camera, and take a little video of the intersection and then put up about 45 seconds of video showing off what they were talking about. And it sparked a conversation from Abdi Bihi. And next to Abdi here is Julia Opati, who is our, she basically works for eDemocracy an hour a day as our community outreach and information leader. She's a journalist by trade from Kenya originally. She actually runs Kenya Imagine, which is a Kenyan blogger network from Minneapolis. But Bihi, you may recognize him if you look closely, if you watched 60 Minutes the other week when they had the big story about terror in America. He's become the voice for the families that at least 20 youth have gone missing who have joined Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And so, you know, one day he's forwarding information for parents to use with their children to say, here's why you shouldn't join Al-Shabaab, right? Why you shouldn't go back to Somalia to fight Ethiopia or join Al-Qaeda, whatever you want, however you want to describe it. And then the next day it's a discussion about crosswalks or bikes being removed by security outside the apartment complex. And so he's been using it for some traditional community organizing, and it's been very interesting. And he basically invited us down for a tour. He saw my crosswalk video and said, I really want to have you come. And he basically walked us around and just wanted to sort of make us more aware of some issues as he sees them in the community as we work with them to have this be a vibrant space. Little Mekong. This is a discussion started by Boa Lee. Boa Lee is our outreach person in the Frogtown area. She also has some partly a journalism background, but she used to be a community organizer for the neighborhood council. And she has a day job now in the financial services industry, so she's actually, you know, working for us in the evenings. And she had met with the head of the Asian Economic Development Association. I'm saying the name wrong, but essentially she became aware of their interest in rebranding part of University Avenue, which is part of this Frogtown area, Little Mekong, like a Chinatown type name. And a big discussion, but it's interesting because most of the first reply were mostly from 50-year-old white men that said, hey, I remember Mekong. You know, that's not a term that I want to have associated with the area where I live. You know, I don't want to, I don't think that's going to be a good term. Back and forth, you know, questions about, well, it's a very diverse neighborhood. Why would we want one ethnic group to have sort of special branding? Shouldn't we, you know, be inclusive of all, and aren't we just Frogtown? And other folks suggesting other types of Asian names. But it wasn't until post number 25, other than Bao Li having started the topic, that an Asian person actually replied in the discussion. And it's important to note that, you know, obviously all immigrant groups are different in terms of how they communicate publicly. But I referred, when I said to Bao, you know, she did a great job seeding this topic, and I said, this is sort of a bookmark for us, you know, and one of the things that we want to evaluate throughout the year is, you know, what are the things that we can do to make this a safe, comfortable space, or a dynamic enough space that people will use it to have an influence or have a say in their neighborhood, and that the actual diversity of what lives there will come out. And that's our goal. And we're learning as we're going, and we're not aware of this type of hands-on work being done sort of in terms of digital inclusion. Like I said, mostly it's about access or maybe some sort of news-type tools, but the whole dialogue piece is something pretty unique to us as far as we know, and we'd love to learn about other projects. Just quickly, I'll mention three other stories that you can click through on here. Potawatomi Park, there was some violence and someone was shot in their alley behind their house, and they posted a note saying, you know, what happened with this? And this was, you know, traumatic. They're also shooting the same day, the Cinco de Mayo, and a lot of confusion about, you know, were these related? I guess there were three different shootings that all happened in the same day, and this one turned out to be apparently a gang shooting, which wasn't related to Cinco de Mayo, but, you know, the community kept asking for information, and we had the city council member actually provide some information, and then people forwarding information from the police that they had received. A big dynamic discussion, and then last Saturday they started, there's four different initiatives, some that were already in the works, but basically the forum is being used by the community to generate a response. And sort of we look at this as like a target opportunity for the next round of inclusion work, where we want to begin to focus on how do we do inclusion across all 20 of our neighborhood forums in the areas that aren't sort of majority minority. It's a real interesting thread. Bemidji, we've had resources from the Blandon Foundation that we just actually closed that grant after a couple of years of work to launch off four neighborhood or call them issues forums in rural areas. So Bemidji, Minnesota, big discussion about someone trying to save their chickens from the city, telling them to move them out of the city. They had a license, but then someone complained, and so they used the forum to get advice. In Leech Lake, Cass Lake, Leech Lake area, we have a forum in a majority Native American population area, and there's a video behind that link of a woman who toured me around Cass Lake. It took me from building to building. She figured out where we could find the mayor just walking down the street of Cass Lake. It's a town of 700, right? It's not a big town. There's about 3,000 people in the school district, and so that's kind of roughly the area we cover. And, again, it's well over 10% of the population in this one, which is another notable thing. And she made the comment that since the forum merged about a year and a half ago, because of the forum and some of the physical events that people on the forum began to organize, they had some of these monthly sort of gatherings that were fostered for the first six months anyway. She said she had interacted with more non-natives than at any time since moving to the reservation 11 years earlier. I had to say, what? Really? And so there's some really neat sort of examples there where, you know, if you with intent bring this into you know, diverse communities and work with them. We don't build a forum for someone. We make sure there's a local volunteer forum manager and the like, and that's also very important to note. And we are doing a big evaluation this summer, working with Rainbow Research and Ann Carroll, who is here in St. Paul. And we're definitely looking to share as much as we can from this. And if you have a particular interest in the evaluation of this, we're just sort of firming up the whole work plan between now and December. So if you want to chip in a little bit in terms of advice, that'd be great. So secret sauce here to finish up. Key lessons: civility and real names build trust, real community. There's a reason why Facebook works. Now, we've been using real names since 1994, and everyone thought we were crazy. because no one knows your dog on the internet. That's sort of the way the newspapers have adopted the commenting technology. And why I'm so critical of them, essentially you have this very, by default, you know, you encourage people to use sort of the worst form of interactivity online in terms of civility. And in a local community, you don't want to look around across the street and say, is that the person who, you know, called me names online? and so it's really important, and real names work. Outreach matters. So here you can see an online version of our paper form. If any of you do the stuff day to day, I mean, the most important thing we figured out is if you have a dashed line for the email address, people generally print. If you have a straight line, you can't read at least 25% of the email addresses. And like I said, our system requires real names, so we just get the first name, last name, and we can upload them. And something we also do, which is really kind of odd, once you sign up on paper, you never have to go to the website. We'll just upload you. And if you want to go to the website, if you want to upload your photo or fill out a profile, you can, and then you can get a password. But you're actually able to receive all the messages and get a digest version instead, as well as post. And that's my final bullet here is that, you know, while it's nice that websites can look nice, if you enable it so that if someone can push reply, they can publish, you're going to have a far greater diversity percentage of people who actually post in your online group. And most of the tools like Ning or Drupal, out of the box, Drupal, for example, doesn't support that type of publishing. And I'm interested, obviously, in how all these different tools do a better job. And Facebook, actually, allows you now to reply via email to comments put on your wall. It's not for the group feature, but they've kind of learned too now that if you make it easy for people, the challenge is that if you're working with a site that's based on advertising, where they need a web view, a lot of sites are hesitant to allow people to actually publish without having to be hit by an ad. So that's I think that's one of the main reasons why you don't see a lot of email publishing built into a lot of these more advanced web-based tools. The other thing is to reach people where they are. So at a local level, you know, there's some towns that have really vibrant neighbor blogs, others that have big email lists. And the challenge is that if one technology works better than the other, or sorry, works first, that's where all the action is, and people kind of stick where the action is. But some people just hate email. They don't want their box filled up. And so, or they don't go to a website more than twice, right? They just don't, they don't pick up new surfing behaviors. They'll go to CNN and Yahoo or whatever, CNN and Google, but they won't, you know, go to some web address they can't remember for that neighborhood blog that they once went to. And, you know, no matter the tool, you want to allow people to sign up and say, keep me informed. So give people the option to get an email update from you. That's key. If they don't leave your email address to at least get updates from you, you're not creating a relationship with them. But in our case, we allow people to turn off email completely, but we encourage them to get what we call a daily digest. You can do it all via the web. We're feeding our groups into Twitter, also into Facebook pages. And it's taken a lot of work to sort of do this, but I think it's really important to note that at a local level, you want to reach people where they are. Last set of lessons here. We're learning in our current outreach work that immigrant groups are increasingly using Facebook. I was talking to a Hmong gentleman who does neighborhood organizing, and he's sort of like the political friend. And so he has 700 friends, and his wall is a big discussion space. But he talked about how, you know, other than having to go defend his community on Star Tribune because, you know, people are telling them to go home to their home country because of the lack of Somali police officers, of police officers that speak Hmong when that story hit, and some other stories, it's just not real safe for us to go out there in the wild in that sort of place, and, you know, why would we waste our time? And so, you know, I'm trying to listen to him and learn from him about how could we, you know, make the content of our dialogues more portable into a Facebook environment, or how does someone call him a hub, right? How do we work with him so that he posts things onto his wall so that over time people will come into the community space where, and understand that our use of real names and requirements of no name calling and our orientation towards civility will make it a place that you won't get blasted just because of who you are or because of how people treat you because of who they think you are. Another key lesson, elected officials, they love, they, sorry, people love the neighborhood forums. People love the neighborhood forums. Elected officials will participate with their voters. So we found now that we have these neighborhood forums within actual city council districts, they'll do constituent services. Their staff will post. They'll gather information. They'll report back. They'll do the kinds of things they would do at a community meeting. And so there are many elected officials who lurk on our citywide forum but don't post, but now do post on the neighborhood forum. We have a blog also where we share lots of lessons. And I think there's a missing gap somewhere here at the block level, the building level, the township level. And NeighborBee is an open source project that we had some volunteers working on. And we'll see how that emerges. But if you have an organization that was active at the block level, we're very interested in connecting with you as well, because in this case, we're interested in how you create semi-private spaces online, different than our issues forums, which are very public. But how could you create small 25, 50 person groups at the block level for communication? There are examples of that happening with the CC via email or with small little email groups, email lists, but there's, I think, an opportunity there. So I had all these reflections up here, and I've sort of talked long enough, and I don't think I need to say anything more about them. And I'll just say that, I'm a big believer in general spaces that can be used for all sorts of purposes. But you may have a specific goal, say, around problem solving or collaboration or something where you have a higher order goal. Just note that, you have to still build an audience. And so how you get people into your spaces that you might host yourself or that someone that you fund might host is a really important question. And so we're basically trying to get people in there to help find out how to recommend a good plumber one day, to also then talk about solutions to crime or programs for youth or a lot of the civic engagement work. And but if you really want to focus more narrowly on it, let's say a time-based event online, it's just important to make sure you have significant resources in your outreach budget so that you bring people in as you come to do various online gatherings. So some last advice for funders, things you might do in your community. I mean, most of you are very much oriented toward grassroots funding in specific communities. Promoting this idea, I think, is just a good thing. And there are probably people who are already doing some of this in some parts of your town, so find them and encourage them. I think a good conversation, if you know the editor of your newspaper and you haven't liked the quality of the commenting and what it's doing to your community, bring it up, because they can improve what they do. There are a number of newspapers that have shifted to defaulting to real names or have shifted to different types of formats other than, if it's not libelous, we don't take it down. Convene people. Fund or seed some efforts. The key thing that I think for success across the field is how do you get the lessons about what works to the local hosts. That volunteer, or if someone's paid, I guess, who wants to be the host of that online group or that neighborhood email list, how do we increase their success rate? A lesson, while you will have inclusion happen, can happen on a volunteer basis, it clearly requires initiative, whether it's funded or not. And particularly if you're trying to build bridges, that is just something that takes real resources, and I think it's going to be a gap. And the last thing I want to see is essentially all the homeowners of America with neighborhood forums and all the folks that rent or are in lower income areas not able to take advantage of some of these great tools. Don't wait for the technology to stabilize. It's never going to stabilize. I've been involved with this stuff for 15 years. It just continually moves. Think of it as continuous opportunity to learn, right? So you kind of got to jump in, with what you have now and what you can use now, and then build from there. Don't wait. Don't wait. And also, I think it's important to think about ways that you could connect grantees together. So you could use some of these same tools, and we can talk about this in the Q&A, but same tools in semi private settings among grantees. And the key thing, obviously, is how do you have a host or someone who helps facilitate the exchange. I think it's important for us as a field to consider how do we connect people, these builders, across different cities. So we see, like, graffiti, a lot of environmental interests come up in all of our different local forums. And I thought, well, gosh, maybe someday there'll be a way for us to better connect the builders, those connectors in. If there's 100 people in one neighborhood that are doing something, maybe 3 or 4 of them would join a meta group either on a specific issue that they're most interested in or in general, and how could the lessons and the tools flow from community to community more readily. Finally, I mentioned this at the beginning, but with a lot of these neighborhood email lists, neighborhood blogs, they're hidden to most people. And we really need a national lookup, a place where you can plunk in your zip code and find these spaces, the ones that exist, or tips on how to create them with many different tools, not just e-democracies, but others as well. Because while 4% or 8 million people might be a lot, there's no reason it shouldn't be 16 million or 16% or 32 million Americans that could do this stuff every day. And I think you need some major national publicity with where you can find the local stuff. So further information, there's some links. Join us on Locals Online. I'll let you read the Participation 3.0 work, but just to let you know that we're gearing up toward generating some partnership proposals by the end of the fourth quarter. So we're looking for other communities to work with. We're also looking for other nonprofits to work with who are interested in this type of work so that we can share lessons and actually, you know, move this space forward. So there we go.
Awesome. Wow. Thank you. That was amazing. And I had several questions come in while you were talking, Steve, that we'll get to right now. But a number of people did ask, you know, they were if this PowerPoint would be available because they want to really follow all these links. So the answer to that is definitely it will be available on our website. So you can check out all these fascinating things that you've shared with us. So, Steve, let me just start off with a couple of quite particular questions, and they are going to take you back to a couple of places in your presentation. First of all, someone wants to know, what do you think about e-newsletters, and you know, how do e-newsletters fit into this whole picture? And so let's just start with that one.
So that's an excellent question, because it's right on. So if you are an organization and you have a website, at a minimum, you need a regularly produced newsletter, whether it's once a month, twice a month, once a week, whatever your production deadline model is. You need to allow someone to give you their email address to allow you to tell them what's new. And so let's just say you're going to try and use these tools for a two-week online event on a specific, let's say, affordable housing in your community, and you decided to organize essentially an online conference. The bigger your email list, the more likely you can actually pull people into that. And so like the Minnesota Idea Open, they did a pretty good job building up their email list and then used it to remind people about different stages of the competition. They just announced the winner earlier today of the first round on fighting obesity. And so the next issue won't be about obesity. It'll be about some other issue. And but because of this first round, they brought people into that space. The other key thing is that you know, neighborhood associations, a lot of them have email newsletters. And we have a real positive relationship with the Neighborhood Association. Even though we host the forums independently of them, they use it between their newsletters, but also in our case, like with both Frogtown and my Spanish Erickson neighborhood, we feed the newsletter into our forum because it also then can be fodder for discussion. So there's some good synergies there as well.
Fantastic. Let me say what, before I ask this question, if folks out there have a question, if you would raise your hand, you should see a place to do that on your control panel. You can raise your hand, and your raised hand will pop up on my end, and then I'll unmute you and call on you for your question. So let me see some hands go up, and meanwhile, here's another question, Steve. I wanted to know, and I think this was in the part where you were talking about Facebook pages, if these pages are specifically attached to a person, or can they be attached to an organization? So how does that all work?
Sure. So if you type in, I believe, like create a page in the Facebook in the search engine, it should give you, it's actually kind of something that's hard to find information on how to actually create one of these things. There are two kinds of pages that Facebook offers. One is sort of an organizational page. It could be for a business or for a nonprofit, but it basically allows you to sort of create sort of your own, like, you know, almost like a yellow page listing in a sense. You know, you fill out some fields about who you are. You have a wall just like an individual would have. People can put comments. You can decide whether your comments are there first or whether you mix it in with comments from your fans. Or actually, no longer have fans. Now you like a page. Facebook does like to change stuff around on you. Mm-hmm. They've also launched a new thing called a community page, where it's kind of like Wikipedia, I think. It's confusing a lot of people, but essentially they're creating pages where if you see the word Minneapolis, anybody who basically can like that page about Minneapolis and create a kind of an organic community around it, it's going to be interesting to watch that, because if they have a lot of place name connecting points, in some ways Facebook will have then enabled some place-based interaction. I'll just make one note on that, is that sometimes they create a lot of virtual ghost towns, when they're not owned by somebody. So I, as an organization, I would look to create a Facebook page. And if you have what they call a web feed, which is like, the headlines from your blog, if you have a blog on your organization's website, you can actually use a tool. I'll be geeky for a second. RSS Graffiti. And it's an application that allows you to actually take your headlines and put them onto your Facebook page. And we've created a Facebook page for every one of our local forums, and then we're using that tool to take the headlines from our email/web form and put them into Facebook. And if people like our page, then they actually can see in one of their live streams, however you describe it, there's a chance they'll actually be exposed to the forum that way. And so it's another tool that I think you definitely want to look at as an organization.
Okay, neat. Type your question in, then I'll get them out there. So here's the question: how does RSS feed fit into this work?
Okay, so an RSS feed comes out of many different sites, but typically when you go to a blog and you see that little orange button, it kind of looks like a little wave coming out of from a dot in the corner. That refers to an RSS feed, or a web feed would be a simpler term for it. And blogs offer them, newspaper websites tend to offer them with headlines. Anytime you do a Google search, they'll often at the very bottom will say, do you want a web feed about this? Or like Google News, if you just search Google News, you can actually create a web feed, and people follow them in different ways. Sometimes they call a reader. It's kind of complicated, but what people use the feeds the most is somebody will take information from one website and display it on another. So it's actually our forums, in our case, our web feed from our forums is what we're actually feeding into Facebook. We're also taking like the feed from our blog, and we're feeding that into Twitter. And so you can use these feeds to sort of like help communicate between systems. And that's one of the best ways to sort of syndicate your content if you yourself are hosting feeds. And the thing I'll also say about feeds is that as more and more feeds emerge in a community, so you begin sort of mapping out, you have your newspaper, you have nonprofits, you have foundations, you have civic websites, and if there are ways to begin aggregating those feeds in a community so people can find stuff more readily, sort of the what's new, people enjoy that as well. So purely if you have a feed, if you see sites that are basically aggregating, the headlines across your community, definitely encourage those to be listed. And there's some sites. LISC in Chicago with MacArthur Funding are doing work around a bunch of neighborhood news portals. And Pelham. It's sort of the P. Well, there's a neighborhood where they is an example, and they're grabbing. They're generating original news, but they're also grabbing feeds from other sort of community news sites in the community and then presenting it in a package.
Okay, neat. So we have a lot of really interesting questions coming in now. So so here is one from Sheena Solomon up in New York. And so Sheena's asking, how do you address communities that have low access to the Internet? Just talking about low-income communities where most households don't have a computer.
Yeah, so that's it's an incredibly important question. When we started in 1994 with the Minnesota Politics Forum and the discussion on politics and then the election information, that question was front and center because only 4% were on the Internet. This is not a cop-out, but I'll say this, is that it's very important to create the places where everyone can come and not wait for everyone to be able to be there, because by the time everyone will be there, it'll be too late to shape the medium in that way. And so sort of the clock is sort of ticking around like civic engagement in diverse communities, in my opinion, or in lower-income communities, because, you want it to tap the interest when it's there. That said, we deal with this very specifically with the Seat of Riverside work, for example. So we've partnered up with the Brian Coyle Center's Computer Lab. There's actually an AmeriCorps position is called CTEP, the Community Technology Empowerment Program. I think it's techpower.org, but they have AmeriCorps students all around the community, and he's adopted us as a civic engagement project. So there are a number of young people, actually, who have signed up on the forum, and they use the internet via that community center. There's also, we have a relationship with Riverside Plaza. We've been invited in. We haven't been there yet, but we're going to do tabling in the computer lab. There's also people who bring up, and I think it's legitimate, that more and more people are using mobile phones. And the challenge with the iPhone, for example, is that it's like, still like $120 a month. T-Mobile, you can get a better deal. And even some Boost now, the sort of prepaid, you can get a BlackBerry for supposedly $50 a month. But as more and more cell phones have email access, well, they might sign up when in the library. If they can get email on any device, they can follow the forum. And so those are some technological things. The spiritual, I guess, approach, we'll say, or the inspirational approach, we'll say, you know, how do you find the hub? How do you find the person at the dinner table who is online or does go to the library and uses the computer lab? How do you get that person to take the conversation from the online world into the offline world, into the real person space? And I think that's sort of an important strategy. The last thing I'll say is that we did, with Frogtown, we did a bunch of recruitment at the Hmongtown Market where, it's where it's a lot of folks there still don't, many will speak English, but maybe won't write English, and older generation. And Marnie Zhang said to me, you know, who did the recruitment, you know, most of the folks that she was trying to sign up didn't have email. And that's exactly the place where we should be, because for every person that does have email in that community, that's a way to connect them in so they can have a greater voice. And I will also mention one other thing is that the inclusion piece is something that we really want to do a lot more with, not just with issues forums, but also with the whole idea of sort of online civic engagement and some of the next generation ideas that we want to be working on. We really want to help push sort of that question forward. And we're actually in the process of relaunching, it used to be an email list called the Digital Divide Network that sort of crashed and burned technologically on someone else's server about a year ago. And we're going to relaunch that, and it's going to be digital inclusion in general, so digital inclusion network. But we're trying to broaden the discussion from access and technology to also sort of content and voice by strategically hosting that group. And so it used to be 10,000 people on that digital divide email list, and we're hoping to at least start up with 1,000 people, maybe 500 people on a new list that will sort of create that space where we can have more exchange on that issue.
Amazing. Fantastic. So here's a question from Tony. Is it realistic to have a volunteer be the neighborhood's online community builder? If not, what might some typical hours a week be for success or a job description? Who's this online community builder? Who do you want?
So great question. So, our model has been successful the first 10 years because I had a business and I would speak about democracy and internet to governments and they'd pay me in other countries and then I would volunteer in Minnesota, right? And so the problem there, obviously, is that as we've grown from 5 forums to 25, soon 35, that 10% cost is going up. But the key thing that we did, though, that makes us still affordable is that, you know, we don't open a forum without a volunteer forum manager or 100 people signed up. So we actually, you know, the paper sign-up sheets, the reason we use those is because we don't let you start talking until you actually do the outreach work. If you've done those two things, if you've got a volunteer forum manager in place and you get 100 people, there's likely to be someone there who's willing to reply. Because nothing's worse than starting an online neighborhood space and then nobody says anything, right? You get 20 people there and someone says, oh, this is great, and then nobody responds. And so we've tried to eliminate that. And so if you get 100 people, then it becomes more of like a 15-minute-a-day volunteer job, wherein if you're, obviously if people are willing to write stories, do journalism, citizen journalism as a volunteer about their neighborhood, that's awesome. But it's a lot more work than basically forwarding an email that you got from the police about National Night Out or mentioning the news story that you read somewhere else and passing the link along. And so that said, though, I mean, it may be, say, for example, you're trying to foster, say, 10 of these across a region. You should have a person. It could be a quarter time. It could be a half time. It could be full time, depending upon just sort of how intensively you want to do outreach. Right now, we're paying, we basically have these two outreach people 7 hours a week, through the year. And we're trying to show that, you know, by having a little bit, you know, $20 an hour, right? It's not a lot of money, but it's what we can afford on a contract. How do we show that by having some resources, we can increase the quality as well as the inclusion incrementally such that when that money runs out, it doesn't end, right? I mean, that's the last thing you kind of want is to, like, have so much into it that nobody has a stake. Sorry, no one's responsible to keep it alive when the funding runs out. And so we're really cautious about that. And if I were to give small grants, say I was going to give $500 to somebody who said they wanted to do this, mm-hmm. you know, oriented toward outreach, you know, food at a community event, paper sign-ups, pay someone to, you know, basically table at 20 different, no, 10 different locations over 3 months. Think very strategically about how you, you know, have it help you get bodies, but don't over-professionalize.
Oh, good. This is related. So this is from Sandy. She just said, Stephen, I'd love to hear some tips for helping improve the quality and depth of discussion on web forums and tips for helping to deal with trolls and angry people.
So that's great. So we've already talked about real names. We've already talked about sort of, well, civility as a goal. So just having, like, you know, the one or two sentences that you use to describe an online space, that matters because the community will self-regulate against it. So if you say it's a friendly space for people who, you know, for neighbors to have an influence on their community, or whatever verbiage you use to describe it, the culture will shape around that. And so you want to look at that real carefully. We have a rule against no name calling, and this is no problem at the neighborhood level. People are neighborly. It's pretty neat. At the citywide level, where things are more political in a large town like Minneapolis, or our statewide forum where things are very partisan, it's tough. It's really hard to get people not to, you know, call people names. And, or they're more likely to call public officials names. So, you know, those limousine liberals or those radical right-wing conservatives. And, you know, we basically have said, well, if someone doesn't call themselves that, that's a name calling. And it gets us in a lot of trouble with some of our more active participants, but we're trying to differentiate ourselves from people that let anything happen, or where name-calling is sort of like what you're supposed to do. So I think it's going to be important to have, you know, rules or guidelines and then enforce them. So that's where that facilitator form manager rule comes in. And this is kind of nuanced, but typically when someone has a blog, they own it, right? And they can delete whatever they want. It's their thing. We actually have some rules and regulations that sort of say, as long as you use your real name, we're not just going to delete your stuff. But we might suspend your future participation based on a warning. So we have a little due process. It's kind of, we're a democracy project. It's kind of weird. But we found that actually works pretty well, because when people realize they're responsible for what they say, they're more likely, and their name is attached. That helps. There's one other thing that we do, which is really weird, and no one does it, and it works, and it's worked since 1994. We say you can't post more than twice a day. Hmm. And what that, it's kind of like, you know, if you're thinking like sort of deliberation or dialogue techniques, you know, it's that talking stick. When you have the stick, you can talk. Well, or when you're in the legislature, right, you can't speak a second time on a piece of legislation until every other legislator's had a chance to speak, kind of thing. And unless you're the author, but in our case, basically, you post once, and you're like, oh, I can't post again for 24, you know, I only can post once more in the next 24 hours, so you hold back. And then more people enter the dialogue. If you were angry at that moment, where you could have posted a second time, you hold back and maybe it dissipates. And so that has worked out really well for us. Because one of the challenges is that when you use email as heavily as we do, if you generate too much email, people just want to turn it off. And if you have two people going back and forth all day, it just drives the audience away. So that's our way of sort of coping with that. And the other thing I would say is modeling behavior. So, like, as the host, or, you know, if you're trying to start a forum up from scratch, you know, you might actually strategize with some of your friends that, hey, you know, let's have a good discussion. Let's show how it could be in depth right away, and actually, like, sort of make it happen. It's not completely manufacturing it. It's just trying to plan it out like you would like a panel discussion or something. And that might be more work than you would expect with an online forum, but actually that's what it might take, particularly if you're doing, like, time-limited online engagements, you definitely want to do a lot of plotting and planning and working with people behind the scenes to have it be a fuller, richer dialogue.
Neat. Well, we have a couple of comments from Cheryl, who is connected to Community Weavers. And so let me read what she has to say. I think there's a question here, but if not, the comment's just really interesting. So Cheryl says that Community Weaving trains Community Weavers who serve as the hubs for the neighbors. Agencies and crisis lines give out phone numbers to the Community Weavers who connect them to their neighbors who signed up on www.goodneighbors.net. So, Steve, you know about Community Weavers? I think you do, don't you? We've talked about it.
Yeah, well, I'll just mention this. So what's been really exciting about, something's in the water, in the last month or so, in part, I'd done presentations and convenings on Neighborhoods Online at the Case Foundation a long time ago, and at the Berkman Center in Harvard. I'd go to towns, and I'd convene people. And every time I'd go, I'd find somebody new, like AmericanTowns.com or this group or that group. And this last round, while you might think that, maybe I only know about half the field. Maybe it's only a third of the field. I don't know. But all I can tell you is that when you go out and try and invite people to join a group of people who do this type of local up building online, Community Weaving and the GoodNeighbors.net site, the Tools Do site, they're honestly newer to me, and I'm really excited about having made some connections there. And the key thing also, I don't know if Romero is on the call, but with ourblocks.net, stumbling upon his blog, someone from the Craigslist Foundation mentioned him to me, and I was like,
today.
Finally, this is awesome. It's just great to see, this kind of neighborhood, sort of dialogue on a blog environment, because the builders of this in this space, can use these tools to further their work, and I'm happy to try and help promote that.
Neat. So here's another question from Cheryl, actually, that came in earlier in the conversation. So she's asking, what's the best approach to share information about a new neighborhood networking site with foundations? We're an all-volunteer effort, so don't have money to join a funders association. So you start something out there. How do you kind of get it out there? So it's your all-volunteer group, and you want to kind of ramp it up.
So that's a really good question. So one of the things that I found with just doing, practicing what I preach and doing my own neighborhood is that, when you get to this level, you get people of all stripes that will join. So you'll have the COO of Pizza Luce, a pretty big, I think it's like four or five, high-scale pizza places in town. You'll have someone who does grant writing for a living. You'll have other people who work for corporations, some folks that work for the newspaper. And so if you've done the work to get a couple hundred people, which can take some time, into a space, that's your starting point. Just as people think about how do you get small donors to contribute, the folks who are going to donate initially are going to be the ones that benefit the most, and there's your $20 or whatever it might be that might come in. Well, same thing about who knows who and how can you leverage those connections. I would say, though, that when you put out, I put out an online query on our citywide Minneapolis forum. I basically said, hey, we'd like to raise $5,000 to help, as an emergency, basically add Powderhorn to our inclusion campaign. I said, somebody here knows somebody at a local foundation that has some discretionary funds, can help open the door for us. I need to go right to the top. I know people sort of on the front lines of the foundation, but if somebody here in the forum knows somebody, and it just kind of went into the wind, right? I didn't get any response, and but at least I tried, right? And I think it's important to note that sometimes, obviously, organizing meetings, things that happen in person. So if you have your base and then get people together, you might get like four or five people that might come to a meeting, and that might be actually then where you take it the next step. And there's nothing like the telephone, right?
Yeah.
It really is a powerful tool to introduce yourself. And I've done I've tried to organize meet and greets here and there as well. And I will say one of the things that's kind of tough for us in the Twin Cities is that we've been around so long, people kind of expect us to sort of just be there, where in many communities where there isn't this kind of activity, we'd be completely new. So there's sort of a mismatch there. You get taken for granted in your hometown sometimes, and you're exactly what another town might be interested in trying to get tapped into.
Yeah, so that combination of high tech and high touch is really important, it sounds like.
That's right.
So we still have time for some more questions. I think I think I've kind of gotten to everyone that have come in. If I've missed anyone, I'm sorry. But if you have something that you want to ask, just type it in and we'll get to it. But meanwhile, Steve, I'd like to get back to the whole notion of our grassroots grantmakers network and thinking about funders working in their own communities. And you know, I hear all the time about how powerful it is when folks can convene, get conversations among their grantees going. And typically those are, you know, in-person conversations. So what advice would you give to a funder who wanted to host grantees in conversation in their own community? So this is more of a limited group.
Right. So a lot of the tools that I showed off here, or just the approaches, can be applied in an invite-only setting or a stakeholder-oriented setting. I think it's important to set realistic expectations and often so that some time limits. So let's, you know, while you could create an email list of all your grantees in a certain program and let them just talk to each other, and that may be simplest and it might actually work really well, or you might, you know, say affordable housing, you know, as a foundation, you might be a ideal convener of people who are working on these different issues, and you're sort of like a neutral host. Just as we're a neutral host of dialogue, you could be a neutral host of sort of like an online community of practice. And actually, you know, the I know the Bush Foundation has been looking into some of those ideas here in Minnesota around, you know, around community leaders and the like. And they're an ideal group. So a couple thoughts. One would be, I have found that online tools work really well leading up to a physical event. So we helped host an online community for the CityCamp Unconference. And CityCamp was basically about government 2.0, local transparency, local online civic engagement. It's a national event that we had in Chicago, about 150 people who came to it. And you know, and basically we used our same technology, the online group technology. Got everybody signed up, had them actually opt out. They signed up to go to the event on Eventbrite, which is a registration system. And I basically said, hey, you know, if you don't want to be part of the online group that's the pre-part of the conference, then let us know. But otherwise, you're going to be part of this online group where we're going to do a round of introductions. And so for about 2 weeks, we moderated a round of introductions. This was a public forum, but still kind of, you know, sort of tightly oriented toward this group. And so that role of host, again, I played that role. And when we got the first 20 out, I said, okay, that's 20 now, but we need to get more, right? Actually, this group was pretty talkative. It wasn't too difficult. But what it did leading up to this physical event is it sort of broke the ice, right? People were able to make some pre-connections and say, hey, man, I want to – privately they may have emailed someone and say, hey, I want to make sure we have a chance to meet one-on-one. It also – people – and this is obviously a wired crowd, so they often had links tied to their projects they were part of. But it allowed it basically allowed the unconference itself to sort of be sort of the value add. And then many times people often will create email lists around conferences, and then when the conference is over, the list is dead, or they'll try and launch it at the event. But the physical stuff is just so compelling often when you're in person that everything is also kind of a letdown. But because we could have built up the community online ahead of time, it actually, for about 2-3 months, the exchange continued at a pretty good clip. Now it's more announcement sharing, but you know, no one's leaving, and it's there to be kicked into action again when another event might emerge. The challenge, obviously, with all of this is that, you know, everyone's creating a new email list or a new blog or a new Facebook group or a new Ning site every minute, right? So there is an information overload issue, and I just say this: if you're the one who's trying to host people, sometimes you just have to be willing to take those risks to overload people for a few weeks, because the outcome may justify the fact that, you know, some people didn't really want to join but did because you funded them, and boom, what do you know, they got something out of it. Or when it's over, well, at least, you know, they were there.
Yeah. Great. Fascinating. So here's a question that's come in from Patrick Corvath, friend in Denver. It says, we have a grassroots grant-making program that makes most of its grants to informal groups of residents. Any ideas on how we might use our grants, which we turn out around very quickly and which are from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars, to seed e-democracy activities in our partner neighborhoods?
So number one thing, two thoughts. One would be, you know, convene sort of an open to all training. You know, it could be, you know, yeah, you could say, here, watch this webinar or go look at that site. But, you know, having someone physically come to Denver and not just tell their story or our story, if you invite me, but use it as an opportunity to have other people who are doing stuff that might be shades of gray similar. So some place bloggers or some others. And there's nothing, honestly, like someone coming from the outside to sort of bring people around the table that really should have known each other ahead of time. And so that would be one thought. So basically sort of seed the idea by, you know, bringing in some of the stories that of things that you've seen in other places. In terms of like a specific neighborhood, let's just say you might send out, you know, post a note saying we're looking for proposals for people who want to do outreach to start online neighborhood forums, and, you know, link to two or three examples in some different cities and say, you know, the grant amounts are available between X dollars and Y dollars, and tell us how you would use that to recruit, 10% of the households. And when I say 10% of households, I basically mean one person per household. That's our guesstimate. Mm-hmm. And see what they propose. I would definitely pay. I would pay for outreach. So someone who's willing to actually deliver real numbers and is on the hook for that's a great scenario. The way we do this is that we host, well, people can take our lessons and run with them. If a neighborhood wanted to be part of our network, basically they come to they send us a note. We basically say, okay, we'll create one for you. If you have a forum manager, we'll set one up. And then we'll say, okay, now you can join our, so we have like a coaching group where we have forum managers, and we're probably going to start a new one for startups because we have 10 neighborhoods in startup here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We never had such a big class of startup forums. We've had a few breakfasts and meetings as well, mm-hmm. but mostly online. And the key thing there would be to basically give them the tools and then go out and get 100 people. And I would say we make it easier now to start a group, but, you know, many of them will not succeed in getting the 100 people because that's actually the hard work. And if they don't, you know, so if you have some money to support that level, that'd be mm-hmm. a good investment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to convene the forum managers, the new forum managers, and get them connected so they can teach each other. What a neat idea.
Yep.
So just in our last couple of minutes, it's just kind of following that thread, Steve. If you're a funder and you want to, and you know you haven't been funding any of this stuff, and you want to get into it, so Patrick got specifically about how to seed this in neighborhoods where it's not going on too much. But what if you're hearing from folks? How do you spot something that's really good and it's going to really generate something at the end, or something that's more of the like somebody's soapbox.
It may actually be value in funding a series of soapboxes as well. But I'll say this is that the you kind of want to look for is, and this is part of our evaluation that we're actually going through. So like because we're so low cost, it's like, you know, we had our evaluation as well. Is it open or is it closed? I'm sort of joking, but a lot of it what we look to is the number of posts per month. So if you're looking at a Ning site, you would sort of say, well, so how many photos are there in the last month, or how many, you know, blog posts and how many forum posts, and just sort of get a sense that there's actual stuff being generated most days. Like if I want to create a neighborhood space, you want to have something new somewhere in your network most days. And it's okay if it's quiet for a week, but, you know, in general, you want to exist in the mind's eye, right? You know, and so if you go dormant for a month, then, you know, people will stop coming to your website, or they'll forget even how to post to it if it's an email list. Mm-hmm. So look for numbers. What else can I say? And then ask for stories. So, you know, a lot of the stories I told you about, you know, such and such person doing X or Y, you know, we get told stories offline, and so if you run into someone who started one of these forums or an email list, you know, ask them. So give us a story about how this has made a difference in your community, gotten in the newspaper, or an elected official or a government agency has been more responsive, where people have decided to get together in person and do something about that. Gathering, you know, four or five of those stories. I mean, that might be your currency. That might be, you know, sort of what helps you justify why you would want to invest in either helping that network grow in terms of mm-hmm. its inclusion or its size, or how you would want to then say, well, we want to have that happen down in the neighborhood next door. I will tell you that the neighborhoods next to my neighborhood and Powderhorn and the ones where we've worked the best, and you know, we're growing out from there. We have a few now that are going to be across the city, but it's been the neighborhoods next to us that have been the most jealous. They're like, well, if you can have that, why can't we? And so that's another thing to sort of note, is that if people who are near a neighborhood where this is working say, we want to do this too, that's actually a good sign that they're actually learning from somebody who's doing it right.
Interesting. So I think we have room for one more question, and I'm not seeing one that's showing up here, but I have one. So here is another one of mine, Steve. So you've talked a lot about urban neighborhoods, urban communities. So what about rural areas? What are you seeing there? Are rural areas part of what's going on in the scene, or is
yes.
Not made it there yet?
Well, you know, the Blanda Foundation, we have received about a $49,000 grant from them, but maybe almost 3 years ago now, and it was to essentially launch 4 issues forums in rural communities. And it's our approach to incorporating community life with our neighborhoods sort of came in toward the tail end of that project in some ways. And so if I were to do that again, I would actually have them be far more community life oriented versus just sort of the town hall approach. Mm-hmm. But so what we have now, Cass Lake has a community life aspect to it, but the other 3 are more like the town hall. But Cook County, Minnesota, population of 5,000, it's like a little virtual think tank. It's been quiet the last couple of months, but they had like 80 messages exchanged about the broadband referendum, and they had someone who worked for the county who was involved in the referendum effort do a Q&A. And there were those obviously very opposed to this, basically having the county basically create a telecommunications company to compete with the telephone company that was there and not providing the broadband they wanted, at least according to some. And so, but a very good give and take. And so one of the feedbacks, though, that we got was that, you know, if you tick off the person who changes your oil in a small town, they might not change your oil anymore. And, you know, my grandmother, she's 86. She's on Facebook. She used Facebook on dial-up. She actually now has a cable modem. You know, in a small town, actually, people tend to know, I mean, obviously know everybody, right? They're in your business. That's mm-hmm. They say my mom's from a small town of 1,500, and so I know about, you know, spending summers there and picking up sort of how the vibe. And so actually in Facebook, a lot of the community work is actually happening via networks of friends because everyone knows each other, or, you know, folks have large farm families and the like. So I should just note that I don't think they're missing out, and in some ways, what I'm seeing happen with my neighborhood forum and the discussions about small businesses or people talking about, you know that they are handyman or whatever, or cleaning houses or whatever, there's sort of aspects of small town life that we don't get to experience, you know, because we don't have the physical places, mm-hmm. we don't all go to the same bank or whatever it is that a smaller town might have, and so I think it's actually a lot we could learn from sort of, you know, how small towns are beginning to use these things, these tools. But I would say, though, I'm not as aware of as many community email lists in smaller towns, except that the Pew Internet and American Life Project is about to launch release a new survey, and I don't know whether they have enough in their pool, but I've asked them to break it down by urban, suburban, and rural to see whether there's any difference there, and I've also asked them if we could take a look at some of the income and ethnic sort of background pieces. The challenge is when you're at 4%, it's kind of hard to sort of use those numbers accurately. And I will say Keith Hampton has done some studies about the digital inclusion piece here. He's an article that came out recently, which he just sent me the other day, but essentially it makes the argument that, the engagement benefits of this far outweigh essentially the digital divide problems, and basically saying that even though a community has digital divide issues, it can benefit as much or more from these spaces than the places that are most wired. So I think it's a really important argument to begin examining, whether it's rural, urban, suburban, poor, or wealthy areas.
Well, wonderful. Well, we're about at the end of our 90 minutes, but Steve, I just want to thank you for a wonderful, wonderful, very energizing and thought-provoking conversation. And so thank you so much for being with us. And, you know, if you have another word or two you want to share about what's coming up with eDemocracy, it's always time. You can here's a little spot if you want to point us to something to be watching for.
Well, I'll just say this, that I think my comment about, and thank you very much for hosting. I really appreciate having met you at the at that event that we met in January, I believe, and having the invitation to speak with your community here. I'm very interested in how we move the field and how we make it possible for Americans and people in any country, for that matter, to find the local spaces where they can be neighborly online. And so the more we can do to make it easier to locate and join the groups that exist, as well as get the lessons out to those who are willing to step up and make it happen, you know, that's the way you go from 8 million to 60 million and on up. And, you know, I do in some ways feel like the clock is ticking and that, you know, in order to have people expect that the Internet is uses a place not just to shout about, you know, local politics on the newspaper, but also to build community and have a say in a way that's constructive. You know, we need to create those expectations now. And, you know, take a look at our Participation 3.0 sort of work there. We have some various online working groups. And seriously, if you're interested in any kind of conversation about what might come from that, you know, we are beginning to sort of shape up our Inclusion 2 proposal as well as, you know, other types of proposals that will, you know, allow us to hopefully serve and assist more communities with their own things, but as well as, you know, communities that would like to sort of help, you know, launch versions of e-democracy in their area. So thanks again, and I'm glad to have got all these questions.
Oh, great. Thanks. And thanks for everyone for being here today. And, you know, check out our website. Give me a day to get all this up here, but I will load up the PowerPoint presentation and the recorded video. So feel free to, you know, share this with your colleagues and check back in to miss something that you maybe didn't catch the first time. So, again, thank you so much for being here, and thanks for Steve. And we'll see you all again another time. Thanks. Bye-bye.